Hello, and welcome back to the Klaviyo Data Science Podcast. If this is your first time joining us, I hope you enjoy your stay. I'm your host, Michael.
And I'm your host, Zach.
We have talked a lot on this podcast about how to build a good machine learning model. We've also talked about the idea of getting your work into production. Today, we're going to talk about a topic that is really at the intersection of both of those ideas, machine learning operations, or as we're going to refer to it for the rest of this episode, ML ops. There are a ton of crucial steps that go into making sure that the environment surrounding a machine learning model or set of machine learning models is healthy, scalable, and performant. And many of them are the sorts of things that you don't necessarily learn in a data science course in school. So to help us today do a deep dive into ML ops, we've brought on four people, four members of the data science platform team who do this in their daily lives at Klaviyo. Let's do a quick round of introductions. Who are you and what do you do on the data science platform team? Let's go ahead and start off with Spencer.
Hello. Yeah, I'm Spencer. I'm the engineering manager for the data science platform team here, and I mostly recruit. We are hiring, of course, always and forever. So do check out our careers page. I've got a background in doing ML ops, mostly in the startup world, building lots of different parts. It's been an exciting run seeing the field evolve. So,
absolutely. Welcome on for the first time. Gal, welcome back on the podcast.
Yes, thank you, Michael. I'm Gal. I'm a lead machine learning engineer on the team. I've been with Klaviyo for almost 3 years now. I started with a different team, more ML-oriented, and then transitioned to the data science platform team later. And I'm really enjoying my time here. Thank you, colleagues, for that. Before that, I've been living with data for quite a while in different occasions, and I'm happy to be back at the podcast.
Absolutely. Happy to have you back. Smit, welcome back as well.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be back. I'm Smit. I've worked here at Klaviyo for almost 2 years now. I am a senior machine learning engineer on the data science platform team. I've been on this team since the beginning, since when it was born. Yeah, our team transformed from the previous team to the data science platform team slowly, and it is amazing to see what this team has built since its beginning.
Absolutely. And Kayla, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Michael. It's my first time, so I'm pretty excited. I'm Kayla. I'm a machine learning engineer on the data science platform team. I just joined the team a little bit over 3 months ago. I'm also pretty new to the MLOps space in general, so I've been learning a ton, and it's a really exciting space to be in.
Absolutely. Thank you all for coming on today. I'm looking forward to talking about this topic. This is a very cool topic, and should we get right into it? Zach, do you want to start us off?
Let's do it. So before we dive into MLOps specifically, it probably makes sense to at least briefly discuss what one might consider to be kind of the umbrella category that MLOps sits within, DevOps. So let's talk about DevOps. How would you describe DevOps to someone who's new to the topic?
So DevOps is in many ways a superset of what MLOps is, but as we'll get to later, there are some differences. In general, what I think of as DevOps is the combination of tooling and philosophy around improving the developer experience. And so there's been a bunch of really great research over the last few decades in this area and a lot of developments. I think there's key books like Accelerate that folks may have heard of. But in general, I think of DevOps thinking about kind of two key dimensions, which are velocity and quality. And so you're trying to make sure that developers or software engineers have the ability to iterate really quickly and produce good code while doing it. And so a bunch of different things feed into that, a bunch of different metrics you might look at, a bunch of different tools. But at the end of the day, you want developers to be happy and healthy, able to contribute code, and do that in a way that is productive for the company and productive for the product.
Yeah, I agree with Spencer there. Yeah, I'd like to think of DevOps as helping software engineers build software without working on a lot of repetitive tasks. So things like deploying something or running testing, building, all of that is automated usually by the DevOps team. And that helps, as Spencer said, software engineers iterate quickly.
Yeah, I think Spencer and Smit covered most of it. The only thing that I would add there is that part of the DevOps experience that's really helpful is that it also automates your testing. So it can also increase the amount of trust that you have in your systems. Like it helps increase the overall efficiency and speed of the system, but also you feel more comfortable with the code that you're shipping.
Yeah, and I guess to give some specific examples of what DevOps looks like in the Klaviyo context. So there is a dedicated DevOps team here at Klaviyo supporting software engineers around the company. And they help us with a whole bunch of tools that do automation. And so we've got things like Jenkins set up. We have a deployment, you know, integration tests that can run. We have automated deployment for most of our systems. We have infrastructure as code. We use Terraform extensively here at Klaviyo. And we monitor all these things as well. So there's a bunch of metrics that get published, for example, by our DevOps team. Each team can see what their code coverage looks like and how well they're doing with bugs. And all of this stuff is automated. So there's a really good feedback loop and teams can take that input and continue to improve their processes. So a combination of tooling, but also a tooling that like supports the development process, but also tooling that supports improvement to all of that process and gives teams signals that they need to make their code better over time as well. So it's a pretty cool setup here at Klaviyo. We've got a pretty mature DevOps team and set of tooling. So it lets us move quick and not have to worry about deploying things and doing as much QA because a lot of that is automated for us.
So we definitely started to get into this here, but just at a high level, what are all of the important things that a successful DevOps program does for developers on a team? What are its essential functions?
Yeah, I can go through what I think some of the essential functions are of a successful DevOps team. So I would say that the most important one or the most well-known feature of a DevOps team is that they help to make faster development cycles. So increasing iteration speeds of shipping out code and just increasing the efficiency of the team in general. Some other things that they do is like improving resource management. So optimizing resource efficiency and doing some like cost analysis to ensure that all like we're not spending too much money. And also, as I mentioned previously, just increasing trust in the overall system through test automation.
The most important part of a DevOps team that I think is the DevOps team taking a lot of feedback from engineers, getting to know all their frustrations and working on it so to make the developers happier and being able to get the developers ship code faster. Yeah, similar to what Kayla mentioned, it improves iteration speed.
To give a specific example of all this that we've been interacting with recently, we've got a monorepo set up. Klaviyo, of course, is going through the world of having a monolith, but then pulling things out into various microservices. But in the process of pulling things out into microservices, we went through the classic stages of everybody building all of their own DevOps infrastructure in all of their own separate repositories. And so there's been a big push underway to get things unified and build a common set of tooling. And so we've got a monorepo that's being set up with some really great automation, consistent patterns for folks to manage packages. We tend to be doing things in Python here at Klaviyo. And so we use Pants as a like a build tool that we use to help in our monorepo. And so our DevOps team, like for us specifically, we've benefited a ton from having consistent patterns. We are able to spin up new services within this monorepo really quickly. We're able to specify dependencies pretty easily in a consistent way. The build tooling is set up so that we don't have to worry about managing all of the build servers and all the resources there. Like that's all handled already. And so we can show up, we can focus on writing the code we need to write. We can get that deployed quickly. It's all automated. It gets packaged up nicely and built. And so all that's provided to us lets us move quickly and lets us know that the code is all tested as well. So yeah, we've been benefiting a ton from having that kind of energy and effort put in to make consistent processes and tools.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's put a pin in that list of kind of important functions. I think that's a great example of that in action, but I'm sure we'll come back to that when we discuss MLOps in a little more depth by itself. But I think before we get to that point, I'd actually like to examine this from the converse side of things. What are some potential systems of not paying enough attention to DevOps?
So I guess I can talk to the history and I can talk to my personal experience working outside of Klaviyo, where DevOps was not as much of an investment. So recent developments in kind of the industry have focused around thinking about, as I mentioned before, like quality, like or velocity and quality. And that shows up in a few different metrics. There's been a bunch of research on this. There's this thing called DORA metrics, which you can go take a look at. A bunch of really cool reports from like Google on this that come out every year. But in the long story short is there's kind of four key metrics that have been identified as being like indicators of successful companies. And conversely, less successful companies don't do as well on these four things. And the four things are deployment frequency. So how often are changes being shipped in the code base? The lead time for changes, how long does it take to get something new out the door? This idea of deployment recovery time, which we track really closely, for example, here at Klaviyo. So if you have an incident, how quickly can you respond to that incident and deploy something new to fix stuff? And then the change failure rate, which is to say, when you deploy something new, how often does it break? And so those end up being four really good kind of North Stars for companies to think about. And so when things aren't going well, you might have a lot of bugs. So I've worked in worlds, for example, where there was a ton of QA and things took a really long time to get out. Like you would have code releases. This was kind of an old fashioned way of doing things where you might have developers might work for 6 months putting together a whole bunch of code changes. And then that all gets batched up, gets tested by a bunch of QA people, and then deployed in one big group. And so all of a sudden the lead time for changes is something like 6 months. And if there's a problem when you deploy, then it's going to be like another 6 months before you might fix it. And so it meant that there had to be a ton of QA work, but the change failure rate didn't end up necessarily being any better because there was 6 months worth of stuff that was getting pushed out all at once. And so you can imagine there were bugs hidden in there and all sorts of other issues. So I've worked in a world like that. It can be pretty challenging because speed and quality tend to go together. If you can deploy things quickly and iterate and have small changes and push your stuff out and see what happens, roll it back when it doesn't work. Like all of that lets you move fast, understand quality, and do it in an incremental way and in a collaborative way. So yeah, those are my thoughts.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with Spencer. Like velocity and quality are definitely the first two metrics that come to my mind when I think about like good DevOps operations. To add to that, like I would add like manual processes and also people not reusing shared components. So teams living like in parallel worlds, that's just like a recipe for chaos, because then whenever you have this shared collaboration, things tend to break up. And then like, again, we end up in the quality velocity equation. So that just wanted to add my 2 cents on it.
Yeah, Gal and Spencer share really good points. The only thing I'd add to it is when you don't pay enough attention to DevOps, every team would be trying to create their own set of DevOps tooling, which results in lots of different DevOps tooling, which are all not good. And they're all trying to go to a table state, the best state. And it's just wasted effort. It's better to just have a single team focus on doing all of that than have multiple teams doing the same thing.
So at this point, we know what DevOps is, and we have an idea of what DevOps is not as well. So in that case, let's talk about what exactly we mean by MLOps. We have a list of what DevOps does and what it means to be successful. What distinguishes MLOps from the broader DevOps category? Are there unique hallmarks of what a healthy MLOps environment looks like in particular?
From a definition standpoint, MLOps is really just focused on the life cycle of a machine learning model. So going from training through testing and deployment, ensuring that all of these models are scalable, reproducible, and maintainable.
So piggybacking on Kayla's definition, the key differentiator there is that you're thinking about what machine learning engineers or machine learning modeling folks or data scientists are doing as opposed to a software engineer specifically. So it's a slightly different group of people that you might be serving, and they're doing a slightly different activity, which still involves writing a lot of code, but also involves creating model artifacts and working with data and dealing with all the constraints of those things.
Yeah, just to add to Spencer and Kayla's definitions for MLOps lifecycle operation, I think that the major difference from DevOps is the dynamic of like all of these different components from the beginning of the process, where we just like treat data and change it so we can then digest it to the actual model, And then like the dynamic way of this model digesting this data and different outcomes that might come up out of it to the actual prediction and results that we might provide. And the fact that all these steps might change and reflect things about the way we process data, the way we create this model or train this model, or the way we evaluate the results that we get out of it. So our focus is a bit different rather than just like continue deploying and making sure that things do not break. We also need to ensure that the quality of each of these steps and each of these stages is kept above some threshold. And otherwise we need to act.
It's a field like thinking about DevOps versus MLOps. It's not that MLOps really is a subset or like a slightly derivative version of just DevOps. MLOps is a very new field. So the definition is a little bit in flux, but it's also a space where I think to me, this is both exciting and a stressful dynamic in that there's just like tons of evolution and it's a huge domain. And so when I say that, like DevOps, in order to support analytics and exploratory data analysis, a DevOps engineer might look a lot like an analytics engineer or a data engineer. You know, we're thinking about data pipelines, we're thinking about data warehouses. In our case, we've got a really big data lake and we're thinking about batch jobs and streaming jobs. And so all of a sudden an MLOps engineer starts to sound like a data engineer and has to understand some of that world. But then on the other side of things, you also have to work with data scientists really closely. You also have to understand modeling. You're also, of course, still writing code and dealing with folks who are writing code. So you're still thinking like a DevOps engineer as well. But then to throw things on top of that, you're also thinking like an infrastructure engineer. You know, we write a lot of Terraform here. We're managing a bunch of resources that deploy servers and run really large batch jobs and deal with orchestration. And so MLOps is similar to DevOps, but it's also similar to being an analyst and being an analytics engineer, being a data engineer and being an infrastructure engineer and being a data scientist. And so it's a tough space in that you have to understand a lot of different elements and you have to know how to fit them all together. And you have to be able to kind of work in these different modalities and work with different people who are thinking about different types of problems, because to build successful machine learning, you have to bring all these different pieces together. So exciting, cool, new space, very dynamic, but it is also broader than just purely developer experience for data scientists.
Yeah, if we go back to that list that we had from earlier, kind of making faster development cycles possible, improving resource management, increasing overall trust in the system, and then taking feedback from your developers, it sounds like you're talking about pretty fundamental changes or like pretty fundamental implications on all four of those categories, in addition to those all four of those categories not necessarily capturing everything.
I think at the end of the day, we still think about quality and velocity. It is maybe helpful to frame things in terms of the way DevOps engineers think about stuff, which is to say, we care about producing quality models. We really like them to be responsible, you know, and think about bias and their impact on society, for example. So it's still quality, but it's maybe a wider and different definition of quality, because we also care about software quality. It needs to do what we want it to do. But then we also have to think about all these other dimensions. And then on the velocity side, we still care about people being able to produce code quickly and produce a new product feature quickly. But they also need to be able to do that at the experimentation stage. They need to be able to produce a ton of different versions of a model. They need to be able to do hyperparameter tuning. They need to be able to discover data sets quickly. And so it's also velocity, but it's even, there's so many more activities involved in machine learning. We have to think about velocity at a whole bunch of different stages as well. So velocity, quality, still good metrics, still a good way to think, frame things, but there's a lot of different versions of it.
I think you've already started getting into it, but thinking it not just a general level, but also a Klaviyo level, are there any unique aspects for how we have to go about having a healthy MLOps environment given Klaviyo's business, given Klaviyo's tech stack? Are there any things that are maybe not completely unique about Klaviyo, but that are part of Klaviyo's operating model that add complications there?
The major thing with Klaviyo is that we are focusing a lot on AI, and which means that we have a lot of different machine learning models being built, and not all of these models are big. Some of them are small. So it means that you need a way to deploy all of these tiny machine learning models into production quickly, and you don't want to repeat all the infrastructure work. As we mentioned previously, you don't want to build separate infrastructure for every tiny machine learning model that you build, because within a quarter, you may have like 10 different ML models being built. So Yeah, that's the big challenge here at Klaviyo, is figure out a general way to deploy all of these ML models into production without building separate infrastructure for all of them.
I think something else that's unique about Klaviyo, and maybe we're going to see more of this in the future, is that there's different places where models could exist. So we can have models that are more internal, kind of like what we're seeing right now, which are being built by like data science and are embedded into our app. But in the future, we might see Klaviyo's customers want to use their own models through our platform. And we're not seeing that right now, but that's something that we'll have to keep in mind, like in the future, and how like the team might evolve over time to supporting that.
That is an important thing to remember. Some of our customers are, they have an entire team that all they do is email marketing. So they might actually have like their own data scientists in-house that I don't think every company that does machine learning actually has that. I don't know if it's necessarily even a constraint. It's like an additional opportunity.
I think that another thing that is probably not just unique to Klaviyo, but it is one of our challenges, is that we have a lot of data. And we are also rechanging and making sure that the data platform is evolving over time. So we have to also adapt to all of these changes in order to provide like a better lifecycle of a data science ML project. And to add more to that, like we also have a lot of customer data, which also caused a lot of like legal / PII consideration that we have to take into the overall equation in order to provide the most responsible models and infrastructure that we can for those challenges.
So something that I think we referred to earlier when we were talking about kind of the health of an overall system with DevOps was monitoring and alerting. Are there unique needs when it comes to monitoring and alerting within MLOps?
Yeah, we are in a very unique situation since our world is very dynamic. We do not just monitor in order to alert or in order to get cost estimation or just to say that something is bad and maybe a new type of cyber attack is started on our endpoints. We can also use that to actually change what we recently deployed. So we can trigger new training processes and then deploy a new version of the model or the data set that we're using. And we can basically trigger a lot of like next steps for our models, given the type of monitoring we set up for this specific model or the other.
Yeah, I completely agree with everything that Gal said. And would just add to that, that typically in DevOps, you'd see more like system monitoring. So looking at latency and just is the server up and running and alerting on if things like go down. But in MLOps, we're also, we're looking at all of those things, but then in addition, just like how is the model itself performing? So we'll look at things like if there's data drift or if there's like anomalies in the predictions or is the model behaving fairly. We can look at accuracy at times and precision. So more like model specific behaviors in addition to just system behaviors.
Yeah, I think that gets at a point that we've actually brought up in past episodes on this podcast before. When it comes to monitoring, the parts of the system that really matter was the phrase that got thrown around a lot, rather than just one size fits all or more downstream monitoring, like, okay, what's your overall memory usage? It makes a lot more sense to actually monitor the parts of the system that really matter. When it comes to machine learning models, are there any tricks to figuring out what those parts of the system are?
I'd say it really depends on the use case of where the model is being used. For example, you may have a classification model that gets continuously retrained every X number of days. You may have monitoring there to make sure, hey, you're able to get certain percentage of precision or recall on that model and send an alert if it's below a certain threshold. But depending on the use case, the other thing that you should also monitor is that do these labels that we are classifying this data into make sense, or do we need to think about this entire thing in a different way? So you want to monitor all the downstream metrics on how are these classifications being used and are they helpful, things like that.
I think that there is another, so I totally agree with what Smit just said. I think that there is another aspect that usually we don't see in standard traditional software development, which is heavy models that we might need to put in production. And then things can get trickier because first, like, we need to use like a different set of hardwares. So we might need to use GPU, but like setting the right settings for the autoscaling can be really, really, really difficult because first, we're dealing with a lot of memory. And second, the memory usage might scale with input length. So if we didn't prepare for the right set of inputs, that might also like break our system. So it's not like we can define very strict boundaries for each scenario that might happen. And so we have to also use our background, like in ML, exactly as Spencer said earlier, we have to act as like data scientists or ML in order to fully understand like the potential, the break potential and the failure potential of what we put in production. So it also connects to like how to properly monitor hard use cases like that.
To give a specific example of a model that folks on this call will be familiar with, we've got some models that we deploy for compliance. And these models, of course, we're looking at things like fraudulent activity. And so in that kind of situation, it's really important to think about drift, for example. And so like that's something that we thinking a lot about monitoring, you know, because fraudulent behavior is going to change over time, for example. And so it's important to make sure that we know when to retrain our model. We're also dependent on all sorts of different data sources. That's like a model where we specifically care about like data drift, for example, like the inputs might change over time or might break. And then one other thing that's kind of interesting there to Gall's point is we deploy one of these models we deploy with GPUs. And so we care about all this normal systems level monitoring stuff, but we also care about, because GPUs end up being so much more expensive and you can't necessarily request, you can't horizontally scale them out indefinitely, we have to pay attention to costs and we have to pay attention to utilization of the GPU. So we want to get really as close as we can to like 100% utilization of the GPU. So we have been leveraging tools like Ray. It's one of the tools that we use a lot here, which can help with stuff like that. But those are kinds of things that other engineers and other backend or infrastructure or DevOps engineers wouldn't necessarily think about because they're not constrained by running machines that cost hundreds of dollars a day. So yeah, so hopefully that gives you a specific idea of some of the stuff we care about.
I'm sure some of our cloud vendors are a little sad to hear that we are interested in not spending infinite amounts of money on GPUs. But I imagine the shareholders probably are happy.
I think they'll be okay. There's a lot of enthusiasm right now for large language models and stuff. So plenty of people to spend money on NVIDIA GPUs.
Yeah, and not just for production purposes, also for experimentation, where data scientists can get really wild. But we have to support that, and we want to support that.
So on this theme of exploding costs with wild GPU instances, we talk about scalability all the time on this podcast, and that's because it's a very important topic. How do you help ensure scalability for data science, machine learning, and AI workflows? Are there unique challenges with doing that or unique tricks that help to make sure that you're doing it well?
A big challenge that I can think of with scalability is generally when you think about scaling in software terms is that you add a bunch of different replicas and scale things that way. With machine learning, that becomes a little difficult because we use this expensive thing called GPUs and you cannot always just add like 10 other replicas of GPUs to get the amount of scale that you want. You need to think about other things like, hey, are we using this GPU completely? Is it justifiable to add more instances of GPUs before scaling out? And yeah, that's the biggest challenge that I think we face with scaling and GPUs. We, as Spencer mentioned, we use this library called Ray that helps us maximize our resource utilization before we add more compute, and that results in a lot of cost savings. Yeah, I think someone recently did an analysis at our company of utilization of different instances, and we found out that generally with other CPU instances that our software engineering teams use, people were using less than 10% of CPUs most of the time, and that is really not acceptable for machine learning models on GPUs.
To touch on some other unique constraints we have in the MLOps world around scalability. Models, as Mitt mentioned, can be, and Gal mentioned, like they can be large, they can maybe require a GPU. We have a bunch of models that run really slowly, or at least slow by web standards. So you wouldn't want to have them be part of like a synchronous call within our web app. And so there's also more classic things that we do to get around that. So we'll do stuff like have jobs that run once a day, for example, and pre-compute results that then get shared later. A lot of the time, at least for a lot of our use cases, we don't necessarily have to have super fresh inference results. And so that can be just a really easy way to just run batch jobs. The data might be a few hours stale, but that's still good enough. And yes, we'll do background jobs. Yeah, we'll try to pre-compute things. We also, of course, have all the standard software engineering things of like horizontally scaling all of our online deployed models. And yeah, so some other stuff that we do.
Yeah, just to add a little bit to what Spencer and Smith said, I completely agree with what they said. And because we have to be cautious of spending too much money and also having our models like take too much time to run, there's a pretty big focus on like code optimization. And you'll see that in other like software roles as well, but it can be like a really, really important here because otherwise you could be spending tons of money or your customers might have a really terrible experience. So we really have to make sure that our code is as efficient as it can be before we're shipping it out.
That maybe touches on an interesting thing. This week, for example, at Klaviyo, we're running a series of workshops. So Gal, for example, is running 2 days of workshops for data scientists. And so there's another dimension to our job, which is we, of course, are supporting all these data scientists. But in order to do that, we need to go beyond just tools. We also need to educate people and get them comfortable with the tools. The MLOps world is constantly evolving. It's pretty hard to learn everything in school when it gets changed every year. And so a large part of our job is education as well, which is kind of fun. Yet another dimension to MLOps. I don't know, Gal, if you want to talk about what kind of stuff we are teaching.
Yeah, I can elaborate more on that. Basically, our mission is to connect data science, not just with us, because we are collaborating well as they are our customers, but also to connect them to the rest of engineering, because data science is not just an isolated world where you just build cool models and just deploy them as a black box. Sometimes we are part of a chain and a part of a critical path, and we have to comply with the standards and with the best practices that the rest of engineering faces. So our job in the workshop is to make sure that we fully utilize what engineering has to offer and also to focus on code optimization and best practices in general when it comes to software in order to fully enhance our models and their performance capabilities. So it is a really cool workshop. We're doing that for the first time. And I really hope that it will be the first one among many other workshops that will either help our data scientists or help the other side, like the rest of engineering, to better understand like the complexities and the challenges we face in the data science team. So I'm really looking forward to it. We might even have another podcast about it, but that's for Zach and Michael to decide.
In the meantime, I think that's a perfect segue to our next question, which is obviously that's something that's a little unique in terms of day-to-day activities. And really, there are kind of three groups of people that I want to compare to here, which is there's like a quote-unquote typical developer, a quote-unquote typical DevOps developer, and then a quote-unquote typical machine learning engineer or data scientist. How would you say the day-to-day of someone working in MLOps is different from those groups?
I like to split our day-to-day work into three different components. We work on building platforms that help data scientists and machine learning engineers deploy their machine learning models into production. We also work on building some tooling that help our customers access data, access our platforms better, things like that. And then the third part is we work on support. So we pair with data scientists on a bunch of different tasks like optimization of their code, how to better put their models into production, and also educating them on these different principles like Gal mentioned. That ideally would be three different teams, but at this point we have a single team that does all that, and it is very different from a traditional DevOps role. I guess some part of it, like the support and building tooling, is very similar. But yeah, typically we deal with a bunch of machine learning models. We need to think about the data scientist perspective on, hey, how is this model different from other models? We also need to think about the product usage of this model to see, can this be deployed in a batch environment where we just run this model once a day versus does this need a real-time deployment? So we need to work with a bunch of different teams. We need to understand a bunch of different context and also somehow fit it all together in a single or a couple of platforms so it serves everyone generally.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with what Smit just said. And like in an ideal world, we would have a unified platform that will serve all models equally. But in reality, we have to adjust, change, modify, customize, personalize the way we implement different pipelines depending on the exact use case and depending on the exact model code. So we have to familiarize ourselves with the actual problems that we are trying to solve and make sure we tailor the exact solution to that use case. Not to mention the fact that some of the benefits that we might use actually depends on the infra we use. So Spencer here mentioned Ray, for instance. Ray provides a lot of functionality in order to help us better digest data or run parallel inference or just distribute the training process itself. We, as the one that brought like Ray into Klaviyo, knows best about like these capabilities. So we feel like this is our responsibility to fill that gap and ensure that data scientists know how to fully utilize it.
Yeah, and just going back to your question about comparing the day-to-day experience to those three roles that you mentioned, maybe looking a little bit closer at the data scientists specifically, because we haven't touched on that too much. I can kind of say what we don't do on our day-to-day that a data scientist is doing. We're not actually working in the inner weeds of the model itself. So we're supporting data scientists to do things like hyperparameter training and run batch jobs, et cetera. But we're not doing the actual hyperparameter training itself. And we're not looking at the like inner math weeds of an individual model. We're just supporting data scientists in their exploration. So we have to have a lot of general knowledge on a bunch of different machine learning models and understand the complexities of them, but not quite as deeply as a data scientist. We don't necessarily specialize in one specific type of machine learning models.
This is a good moment for me to mention we are, of course, hiring and growing this team. And to Kayla's point, you don't necessarily have to be a machine learning expert to go into the world of MLOps. I think people are going to talk to their backgrounds a little bit more in a minute, but folks who are successful in MLOps come from a huge range of backgrounds, and it's really helpful having a variety of contexts. You can come into this world from the data engineering world. You can come in from being an analyst. You could come in from being a back-end software engineer. We don't do so much front-end, but that kind of experience can still be helpful. So it's a field that is rapidly evolving. Nobody's an expert in it yet because it hasn't been around that long. And yeah, bring your own experience and come ready to learn.
I think that's a great segue to, honestly, this is a really large topic. I wish we had more time to talk about it because there are 5 or 10 questions that I want to ask, but we only have time for one more. As you mentioned, MLOps is a new field. It's a field where maybe there isn't a huge amount of expertise that's just generally available out there. And that is why, as always, I want to make sure we close off with some concrete advice to our audience. And I'm thinking here, there are kind of two sorts of advice that might be helpful to give. It's going to be dealer's choice on what you actually end up giving. And that's, is there any practical advice you would give to either someone who wants to get into MLOps in their career? Or is there practical advice you want to give to someone who doesn't specifically want to get into MLOps, but would still benefit from knowing something about it? Say like maybe your typical data scientist.
I can speak to someone who would want to go into MLOps for their career since I'm pretty new to this sector. I would say the best advice that I received and I followed through, and that's kind of how I ended up here, is to actually work on a project. So there's tons of courses out there and you can read things online and you can watch as many YouTube videos as you want. But the best way to get involved in MLOps is like go and build a model and deploy it yourself. Like go through that process of deployment and like write the Terraform code, make sure like you set up CI/CD and the whole entire process. That's the best advice of how to understand if this is something that you want to do long term and how to like speak to your experiences through job interviews.
I started as a data scientist who realized that the hard parts of what I was doing at these random startups I was at was not the modeling, but getting the data together and deploying the models that were built. So that's kind of how I fell into it. But in general, and I think that's that can be a pretty common path. But in general, I'd recommend for any data scientist, take time to understand good software engineering practices. That is in many ways maybe more important than understanding some of the statistics. Because if you are writing code that brings in incorrect data or has bugs, the statistical results you're going to get are not going to be valid. And so writing code and understanding how to plug your findings into the larger company or the larger product context by writing good quality code is going to be critical for you making impact, no matter what form of data science you're doing.
I agree with Kayla and Spencer here. I think the best way to get started with MLOps is to actually do a project that deploy something into MLOps, and that's I got into MLOps. For me, I was a bit lucky and I got a lot of Google Cloud credit for free for 2 years. And so any project that I built, I was very interested in deploying that model and showcasing it. But I guess try to get free credit because it's really hard to get this experience of deploying models into production without spending any money yourself. Or if you are working in a company, just rotate to your ML team and try to deploy things, and you would know if you're really interested in this role or not.
Yeah, I agree with what Spencer, Kayla, and Smith said here. And I think it's really important to get some hands-on work done in order to fully understand the complexity of the different stages of taking a model from the experimentation phase into the production level. I also extremely relate to what Spencer said about like ensuring you follow best practices from the beginning of a project that's mostly aimed to your data scientists. But if you follow that from the beginning, it will be much easier to transition from the development phase into the production phase, because you will catch bugs earlier. You will know when you did not digest the data properly or when you didn't build the exact feature you wanted. When you will have like a set of tests to support different components, it will be much more easier to run improvements rather than have a chunk of a Jupyter notebook that you need to somehow digest and make modular after spending 6 months on this specific model. So I think that like to connect it back to what we just talked like about how to enter the MLOps world, you have to fully understand like the different stages of an ML or data science project lifecycle and ensure that you are preparing for the next stage and that you are ready for the next stage. It shouldn't catch you by surprise, the fact that you need to think about like the right monitoring metrics or the right set of tests that will ensure that your model is up to date. And it's always good to join a lot of the MLOps community in order to fully understand not just the deployment process, but also like the various tooling that we see out there. Each of these platforms is wonderful, but we have to also familiarize ourselves with it and make sure that we know how to make trade-offs and point out like the cons and pros of each of them.
Yeah, fantastic advice all around. I want to give one final thank you to everyone who was on the podcast today. It was great having you on. Honestly, we could have probably talked for another hour, but for now, thank you for sharing your advice and thank you for sharing your expertise.
Thank you for inviting us.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you so much.
Absolutely. That is it for this episode of the Klaviyo Data Science Podcast. This episode, as all episodes of the Klaviyo Data Science Podcast are, was sponsored by Klaviyo. Klaviyo powers smarter digital relationships. We make it easy for B2C businesses to transform all their data into more valuable customer experiences across all touchpoints, from email and SMS to the web and reviews. More than 140,000 businesses rely on Klaviyo to grow their revenue faster and more efficiently. If you want to learn more about us, go to klaviyo.com. That's klaviyo.com. If you liked what you heard on this podcast, please consider subscribing. Please consider giving us a rating, leaving us a review. And most importantly, if someone that you know is going to be interested in hearing about MLOps, potentially interested in getting into the field or just learning more about it, please share this directly with them. That is the best way to make sure that they learn about the topic. Just share this directly with them. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about this episode, please contact me. I am the best person to reach. The best place to reach me is my Twitter account. That's Lawson_M_T, LAWSON_M_T. Thank you for listening. Have a great month.